Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture by award-winning poet Philip Levine. Levine has earned nearly every major prize available to an American poet, including the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. He's the author of 16 books of poetry, including The Mercy, The Simple Truth, and Ashes, Poems New and Old. We begin with an introduction by the director of Boston University's Graduate Creative Writing Program, Leslie Epstein.
It's a true pleasure to be able to introduce Phil Levine to you. I first met Phil, I first talked to Phil, I don't know if you remember, when we tried to get him to come to BU to read for us so we could hire him. And he quite rightly said, not for what you're paying me. You were at Fresno then, I think. But I didn't really meet Phil and Franny's wonderful wife until we both were together in Bellagio not quite 10 years ago, 8, 9 years ago. And I thought this both of them are simply wonderful. And because of that, I broke my cardinal rule, and whenever I saw a poem of Phil's in any kind of magazine or journal, I would read it. And and there's another reason why I think Phil's poems come alive for me when I read them, and that's because in many ways they resemble the art that Olette and I practice in Room 222. There's a fictional narrative quality, I think, to these poems. Poems that resemble what we do and that are also unlike what we do, as I think fiction is. If you read books like Red Dust or The Names of the Lost and the recent wonderful Breath, Phil creates vivid scenes but in few words. A foundry or loading dock or the bus station in Princeton, New Jersey that doesn't have a men's room. His characters breathe and are capable of surprise, and they speak dialogue that is real yet distinctive. You can hear that unteachable ear for speech, even in some of his titles, What Work Is, They Feed the Lion. In these vivid scenes, the sharp sense of character, the artful dialogue, this poet, I think, resembles masters of fiction. Yet even I can recognize something essentially poetic and lyrical in Phil's poems. It has to do, I think, with the way he sings or laughs or weeps or jokes as himself. The I who says the poems may sometimes be fictional. He's capable of teasing the reader by saying he has just lied in a previous stanza, for example. But the passion is always direct and with ardent candor. He seems physically present in these poems. That's what we mean, I think, when we call poets singers. Phil is what any great fiction writer is, what any great poet is, a truth teller and a beautiful one. I'm proud that I've kept up with his work, and I'm proud that he's my friend.
Thank you, Leslie. That was a wonderfully generous and accurate introduction. I'm sorry I didn't bring the book What Work Is with me, because it has that poem that Leslie referred to about the bus station in Princeton and my oath never to return to Cleveland, Ohio. For which I was chided today. One does make oaths in one's poems that one violates. But I hope never to go back to Cleveland. And so far I haven't. But because I badmouthed Cleveland, I would like to read a poem about the person I think is the greatest contribution that Cleveland ever made to the world. It's called On the Meeting of Garcia Lorca and Hart Crane. Dear Hart Crane, rather despised by Cleveland, some years ago when they were going to put a plaque on the house in which he lived, the one with the turret in which he wrote, the descendants of Hart Crane asked him not to put the plaque up there. Crane and Garcia Lorca did meet. This is about their meeting. They did meet in Brooklyn. They met in 1929. Neither would live very long after this. Crane only 3 years, and Garcia Lorca 7. Crane, of course, would kill himself. And Garcia Lorca would be dragged out to a hillside near his native Granada and executed by the fascists. But for one night, at least one night, they were together. They may have been together for more than one night, because after that, there is a month during which no one knows where Garcia Lorca was. He was not at his rooms at Columbia University, where he had come to learn about American literature and learn the English language, neither of which he did. I've always been pleased by that fact that he couldn't speak English. I thought anybody who could use a language as well as he could didn't deserve to have a second one. On the Meeting of Garcia Lorca and Hart Crane, Brooklyn, 1929. Of course, Crane's been drinking and has no idea who this curious Andalusian is, unable even to speak the language of poetry. The young man who brought them together knows both Spanish and English, but he has a headache from jumping back and forth from one language to another. For a moment's relief, he goes to the window to look down on the East River, darkening below as the early night comes on. Something flashes across his sight, a double vision of such horror, he has to slap both his hands across his mouth to keep from screaming. Let's not be frivolous. Let's not pretend the two poets gave each other wisdom or love or even a good time. Let's not invent a dialogue of such eloquence that even the ants in your own house won't forget it. The two greatest poetic geniuses alive meet, and what happens? A vision comes to an ordinary man staring at a filthy river. Have you ever had a vision? Have you ever shaken your head to pieces and jerked back at the image of your young son falling through open space, not from the stern of a ship bound from Veracruz to New York, but from the roof of the building he works on? Have you risen from bed to pace until dawn to beg a merciless God to take these pictures away? Oh, yes. Let's bless the imagination. It gives us the myths we live by. Let's bless the visionary power of the human, the only animal that's got it. Bless the exact image of your father dead and mine dead. Bless the images that stalk the corners of our sight and will not let go. The young man was my cousin, Arthur Lieberman, then a language student at Columbia, who told me all this before he died quietly in his sleep in 1983 in a hotel in Perugia. A good man, Arthur. He survived graduate school. Later came home to Detroit and sold pianos right through the Depression. He loaned my brother a used one to compose his hideous songs on, which Arthur thought were genius. What an imagination Arthur had. Well, let me read another poem while I'm on the theme of Garcia Lorca. This is called The Poem of Chalk. I lived for, I don't know how many years, on Bleecker Street in New York, just north of Houston. And I was working at NYU then, and I wasn't getting paid enough. That's changed. I now do almost nothing and get paid much, much more. That's the way the world works. The less you do, the more they pay you. But for entertainment, because I didn't have any money, I used to walk. I was younger, and I still walk a lot, but then I walked all the time. And I used to like to walk downtown. Instead of walking uptown, I would turn around and walk the other way because I found it less predictable and crazier and more just wilder. And this came out of that walk. It's called A Poem of Chalk. I also ought to say that it also came out of my reading. I know that sounds, what's the word? Elitist. It is. Poets are to a degree elitist in the sense that nobody reads our art, so if we weren't writing for educated people, we wouldn't be writing for anybody, you know, except our uncles and aunts. And I suppose my children on occasion read me. I never ask them, really. I give them the books. But I don't say, what'd you think of it just before you sold it? And when I say it came out of my reading, I knew that Juan Ramon Jimenez had come to New York in the 19-teens, and he had seen a particular person walking on the streets of Manhattan, and that person sponsored a poem. And then in 29, when Crane came, he actually thought he saw the same person. And it was possible. And it sponsored a poem by Crane. But back in the early 90s, when I saw a person who could have been described by either of them, I knew it wasn't the same person. And I also knew that if I'd been looking, I would have seen him years before. But out of that came this poem, The Poem of Chalk. On the way to Lower Broadway this morning, I faced a tall man speaking to a piece of chalk held in his right hand. The left was open and it kept the beat, for his speech had a rhythm. It was a chant or dance, perhaps even a poem in French, for he was from Senegal and spoke French so slowly and precisely that I could understand as though hurled back 50 years to my high school classroom. A slender man, elegant in his manner, neatly dressed in the remnants of two blue suits, his tie fixed squarely, his white shirt spotless though unironed. He knew the whole history of chalk, not only of this particular piece, but also the chalk with which I wrote my name the day they welcomed me back to school after the death of my father. He knew feldspar. He knew calcium, oyster shells. He knew what creatures had given their spines to become the dust time pressed into these perfect cones. He knew the sadness of classrooms in December, when the light fails early and the words on the blackboard abandon their grammar and sense, then even their shapes, so that each letter points in every direction at once and means nothing at all. At first, I thought his short beard was frosted with chalk. As we stood face to face, no more than a foot apart, I saw the hairs were white, for though youthful in his gestures, he was like me, an aging man, though far nobler in appearance, with his high carved cheekbones, his broad shoulders and clear dark eyes. He had the bearing of a king of Lower Broadway, someone out of the mind of Shakespeare or Garcia Lorca, someone for whom loss had sweetened into charity. We stood for that one long minute, the two of us sharing the final poem of Chalk while the great city raged around us. And then the poem ended, as all poems do, and his left hand dropped to his side abruptly, and he handed me the piece of chalk. I bowed, knowing how large a gift this was, and wrote my thanks on the air, where it might be heard forever, below the seashell's stiffening cry. One of the people I ate dinner with, Frank, said to me, "It's wonderful that you live in Brooklyn 5 months a year. It's a city." People were sort of sticking up as best they could, really rather pathetically, for Cleveland. It's a losing battle. It's great to live in Brooklyn 5 months a year. 6 months a year begins to get exhausting. It's not Brooklyn so much, it's that thing across the river. The other 7 months I spend in Fresno, California. And people say, "Why do you go back there?" Well, I go back there because I have friends there, and friends make a place. And it's because that's where I've written my best work. And poets can be very superstitious. I come from Detroit, which means, you know, you can't screw it up no matter where you go. It's probably worse. I don't want to compare Detroit to Cleveland. I think they should both sink into Lake Erie at about the same speed, right? It doesn't matter what I think, they're going to do it. Let me read a poem out of Detroit. It's called In the Dark. There is in the Detroit River an island called Belle Isle, although it's not quite a Belle Isle, but it's not bad. And if you look one way, you see Windsor, Ontario. And if you look the other way, you see Detroit. And, of course, Detroit looks better from the island than it does in fact. It looks better if you cross over to Windsor and look at Detroit. It looks better there than it does in Detroit. Probably the best view of Detroit is from San Diego. it really looks quite splendid in San Diego. Well, this takes place on that little island. It's called In the Dark. And if you're from Detroit, you make friends with the dark because the place looks so good when you can't see it. In the dark. In the last light of a summer day facing the Canadian shore, we watched from the island as night sifted into the river, blackening the still surface. An oar boat passed soundlessly, trailing a tiny wake that folded in upon itself with a sigh. Unless that sigh was hers or mine. In the darkness, it's hard to tell who is listening and who is speaking. St. Augustine claimed we made love in the dark, though he did not write made love, because we were ashamed to do it in the sight of anything. Although I suppose God could see in the dark, having at least as good eyesight as a cat. Our cat, Nellie, used to like to watch my wife and me at love. But she was not a creature who generalized. And of all things she liked best, a happy household. Quote, "God loves a happy giver," I read in the Abyssinian chapel on top of the Holy Sepulchre, which suggests the old saint had no idea what he was talking about. But in the darkness, it's not easy to tell who is talking and who listening, who giving, who taking, who praying, who cursing. Even then, watching from the island, I thought that making love was a form of prayer. You got down on your knees if you were a boy and prepared yourself for whatever the future held in store, and no matter how firm your plans, without the power of another power, you were lost. It's so dark back then, I can't tell what I'm thinking. Although I haven't placed my hand on Millie's shoulder for nothing. Nor have I turned my face toward Millie's merely to catch a reflection of the darkness in her wide hazel eyes. Cat eyes, I called them then. Millie sighs. The oar boat passes silently to disappear into a future that's still mysterious. I take a breath, the deepest breath of my life, and knowing the generations of stars are watching from above, I go down on my knees in prayer. We were talking today at dinner about, you know, our educations, I guess you could say, about the colleges we'd gone to. And I went to the City College of Detroit. It was called Wayne University. It's now called Wayne State because it got taken over by the state when the city more or less went broke. And when I went, I started there in 1946, and it was a wonderful school for me. It was, I don't think I could have gone to a school in which I would have been happier. This man, Frank, said he went to City College in New York, and he was miserable, although he loved New York. Well, I thought it was terrific. First thing, the war had ended, and so I didn't have to go to it. And so I just felt, you know, whatever the hell else happened, I was, you know, I was going to be alive to eat it up. And then I was very political at the time, and one of the wonderful things about the City College, and perhaps many, many colleges in America, at the time there was this huge spectrum of political belief. It went all the way from, you know, people left of Trotskyites to people who would later found the John Birch Society and elect our current president. So we had idiots on both ends. And I would say in about equal number. And they were about equally inarticulate and idiotic and wonderful because they were so passionate about their stupid ideas. And I liked them, and I felt myself, I've never attracted to the right-wingers. I didn't even like the way they dressed. I mean, they wore suits, the men. The men wore suits. Well, the women wore suits, too. And there weren't many women. But among the extreme left-wingers, the women were perhaps even worse. They lectured you. Don't do that. That was the first line they greeted you with. Don't do that, Philip. You should be ashamed of yourself. Animal appetites. At any rate, I felt myself, you know, sort of like a ping pong ball going back and forth between the Stalinists and the Trotskyites. And I don't know, a couple of years ago, I began thinking about those people with great love and affection. They were idiotic, but they had something that I lacked. And I try to put my finger on it in this poem. I only talk about the idiots of the left in the poem. I give them pseudonyms. I call one Vallejo. I name him after the Peruvian poet, César Vallejo, because of the way he speaks. Sort of, if you've ever read Vallejo, especially in Spanish, you know, you don't know what the hell he's doing. I mean, He experiments with grammar, he invents words, and he just vaults into his poetry with so much passion and power and beauty. He's a great poet. This guy was not. I call the woman Lupino. I name her after Ida Lupino, who was a film star of my boyhood. You could call her the ur-waitress of the films. I mean, you know, if you pull into a diner in a movie and you come stumbling in, she greets you. What do you have? She was an amazing woman, actually. First woman to direct a film in Hollywood. She was actually English, but she could... You wouldn't know it seeing some of her movies. And then I have Two-Card Cohen. I name him Two-Card because he's named after a guy who had two separate Communist Party cards that he liked to show everybody. Like he joined the party twice to make sure that he would go to prison or something. The Communist Party was legal. This was a freer America than the one many of you young people were born into. Every party was legal, the way it should be. Everyone. Every idiot had his soapbox and could say whatever the hell he wanted on the Wayne University campus. And I loved it. It's called Our Reds. Let us bless the three wild reds of our school days. Bless how easily Gaunt Vallejo would lose control, the blood rushing to his depleted face, while his mistress in a torn trench coat stroked his padded shoulders to calm him. We'll call him Vallejo, after the poet, only because he vaulted into speech in such a headlong rush. In truth, his name was Slovakian. We'll call her Lupino after the film star, because she was more beautiful in memory than in fact. Her cheeks drawn over fine bones, her hair tumbling down from under the beret, hair we loved and called dirty blonde. Vallejo would rise in class unasked to interrupt, quote, the tired fascist swill the stunned professor was giving out. Quote, the proper function of a teacher is to inform the unformed cadres of the exploited classes regarding the nature of their enslavement to an estate sold to the masters of the means of production. End quote. Lupino would rise quietly beside him to show solidarity and to begin her therapy. Two-Ton Cohen would join in, flashing his party cards for all to see and invoking the sacred triads of Hegel. And we, the unformed and the uninformed, dropped our pencils and groaned with gladness to be quit of Aristotle's ethics or the monetary theories of James K. Polk, and stared into a future of rotund potential fulfilled. They're gone now, the three, Vallejo, Lupino, Cohen, into an America no one wanted, or something even worse. So bless their certainties, their fiery voices we so easily resisted, their tired eyes, their cheeks flushed with sudden blood. Bless their rhetoric, bless their zeal, bless their costumes and their cards, bless their faith in us, especially that faith, that hideous innocence. Every year, somebody, I forget the publisher, brings out a book called Best Spiritual Writing. And every year but one, I've been in it. As you may have guessed, I may be the least spiritual person you've ever seen. And I haven't quite figured out why I'm in there. But they pay you, so what the hell, you know. And they take it, you know, they take something out of a magazine that got published the previous year. And I'll read one. And then the one year that I wasn't in it, I published a truly religious poem. And it didn't make it. So first, let me read one that did make it. And it probably made it because of the title, Gospel. Gospel, of course, the original meaning is good news, the good news. And I'm using it ironically, I guess you could say. Gospel. The new grass rising in the hills, the cows loitering in the morning chill, a dozen or more old browns hidden in the shadows of the cottonwoods beside the stream bed. I go higher to where the road gives up, and there's only a faint path strewn with lupin between the mountain oaks. I don't ask myself what I'm looking for. I didn't come for answers to a place like this. I came to walk on the earth, still cold, still silent, still ungiving, I've said to myself, although it greets me with last year's dead thistles and this year's hard spines, early blooming wild onions, the curling remains of spider's cloth. What did I bring to the dance? In my back pocket, a crushed letter from a woman I've never met, bearing bad news I can do nothing about. So I wander these woods, half sightless, while a west wind picks up in the trees clustered above. The pines make a music like no other, rising and falling like a distant surf at night that calms the darkness before a first light. Suffing, we call it, from Old English no less. How weightless words are when nothing will do. Some people pronounce that word sowing. It's S-O-U-G-H-I-N-G. But I grew up pronouncing it suffing. All right, now let me read my truly spiritual poem that didn't make it. This is called Houses in Order. It takes place under the Williamsburg Bridge, which is, as many of you undoubtedly know, a bridge that spans the East River and takes you from Manhattan to a section of Brooklyn called Williamsburg. Unless, you want to go in the other direction, it can also take you from Williamsburg to Manhattan. It's a very versatile bridge. And there, you don't have to pay to go across. You just have to put up with the traffic. Houses in order. In cardboard boxes under the Williamsburg Bridge, a congregation of mature rats founds a new order based on the oldest religious principle. They eat whatever they can get their teeth into. By day, they move slowly about their kingdom. Some days so slowly they seem for hours on end to become holy relics, or the stained brown backgrounds to events foretold in parables to do with the savor of salt, the mysteries of mustard seeds, meat, bones, loaves, and fishes. When you look back, they've gone into water or air. They've joined the falling rain that makes vision so difficult, even for the visionary. The little houses keep their secrets the way windowless houses always do, though their walls and roofs proclaim the hour's holy names, Nike and Converse, Panasonic and Walkman. And though they let light leak in through their teeth-torn ports and darkness out from under their lids, they're closed to all but the eyes of the faithful. These dull pilgrims contemplate the business of gathering and hunting while the day hangs on and the traffic drones on the bridge above. Soon the headlights come on, singly or in pairs. The rain gleams through the taut cables. No moon rises above the island, where now they are among us, each one doing a morsel of God's work, until their small jaws ache from so much prayer. I have a long poem in this book, which I'm not going to read. But I want to read one section. It's very, very short. I was lucky enough to also not only go to school at a lively time, but to grow up in a city, the city of Detroit, when it was having a kind of jazz renaissance. It had become, for a short period in the 40s and early 50s, perhaps the greatest center of jazz outside of New York in the United States. And I used to go to these clubs and see the greats, you know, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, Thad Jones, who was local, Pepper Adams, who was local, Tommy Flanagan, who was local, Kenny Burrell, who was local, Pepper Adams, who was local. They were all from Detroit. And I went to school with a bunch of them, with the ones I just named who were local. And they were the first artists that I ever met in my life who were actually living on their art. And there were students at Wayne with me, and they were professional musicians. And it was a very inspiring thing to see that here in America, which seems so indifferent to art, young men and women could actually practice their art and live on it. It gave me a kind of false hope about poetry. Eventually, you know, some 40 years later, I would realize it. Always there was music. Clifford and Max 1 month, Miles the next, Lester Young near the end, half sober, the high off-center wail of the horn like a voice heard before we heard voices. On the Saturday sing-along from the Met, in the back of D'Angelo and Ferenti's French cleaners and fine alterations, the tiny Sicilian coat maker on tiptoe to reach the high notes along with Björling. Della Dobian on the crosstown streetcar as dusk rises from the trees. If you go back, you'll hear her rough alto echoing down the bombed out streets of heaven. And the bombed out streets of heaven reminds me of another poem in this book. This is my new book, Breath. I don't have the book with me. It's heavy. It's a very heavy, powerful book. but what do I have? I have the bound galleys, which weigh nothing. This is called My Brother Antonio the Baker. I am a twin. And I think the poem probably arises out of that fact, as a lot of my poems do, which I didn't realize this for a long time, that a lot of the conversations between men in some of my poems and the deep clasping of one man by another, probably until I read, I can't remember her name, a woman from Yale who wrote an article on me, and I said, Jesus, how come I didn't notice this? But, you know, you write a poem and then you're done with it. And finally, you may not get it right, but you get it as right as you can and you move on to something else. So you don't really think about what did it mean. It meant you had to write that day and you did the best you could. I give the brother in this poem the name Antonio after Antonio Machado, the great Spanish poet of the late 19th and early, he lived till 1939. a marvelous, marvelous poet. And the brother in the poem sort of paraphrases. He's in love with the writing of Machado and kind of paraphrases it. He's always quoting these things. Machado is a poet who's very, very difficult to translate. It's like trying to translate Wordsworth into Italian. You know, I bet you the Italians couldn't. They would look at Wordsworth and say, "So, so, you know, you rode a boat. You know, you went ice skating. You know." That's a poem, you know. You took a walk in nature, you met a guy, you know. An old man, he told you something. So, you know, where's the beauty, you know? My brother Antonio the Baker takes place in Detroit, on the streets of Detroit. Did the wind blow that night? When did it not? I'd ask you if you hadn't gone underground, lugging the answer with you. 28 years old, on our way home after a 12-hour shift, baking Wonder Bread for the sleeping prisoners in the drunk tank at the Canfield station, dreaming of a breakfast of horsecock and mattress stuffing. Oh, the luxuries of 1955. How fully we lived, the working classes and the law-abiding dregs, on buttered toast and grilled cheese sandwiches, as the nation braced itself for pâté and pasta. To myself, I smelled like a new mother, minus the aura of talcum and the airborne acrid aromas of cotton diapers. Today, I'd be labeled nurturing and bountiful instead of vegetal and weird. A blurred moon was out. We both saw it. I know, because leaning back, eyes closed on a ruined sky, you did your thing, welcoming the, quote, bright orb waning in the west, quote, moon that rained down its silver coins on the darkened Duero and the sleeping fields of Soria. Did I look like you? My face anonymous and pure, bleached with flour, my eyes glistening with the power of neon light or self-love. Two grown men side by side, one babbling joyfully to the universe that couldn't care less, while the other practiced for middle age. A single crow settled on the boiler above the Chinese restaurant, his feathers riffling, and I took it for a sign. A second sign was the couple exiting the all-night pharmacy. The man came first through the glass door, small white sack in hand, and let the door swing shut. Then she appeared, one hand covering her eyes to keep the moonlight at bay. They stood not talking, while he looked first left, then right, then left again, as flakes of darkness sifted upward toward the streetlight. The place began to rumble, as though this were the end. You spoke again, only this time you described someone humble walking alone in darkness. I could see the streetcar turning off Joy Road, swaying down the tracks toward us, its windows on fire. There must have been a wind, a west wind. What else could have blown the aura of forsythia through the town and materialized one cross-town streetcar never before on time? A spring wind freighted with hope. I remember thinking that at last you might shut up. An old woman stood to give you her seat, as though you were angelic or pregnant. When her eyes spilled over with happiness, I saw she took your words to heart as I never could. Maybe she recalled the Duero, the fields asleep in moonlight. Maybe the words were music to her, original and whole, words that took her home to Soria or Krakow, or wherever. Maybe she was not an old woman at all, but an oracle in drag who saw you as you were and saw, too, you couldn't last the night. Well, let me close with one more poem. A sort of something about my city again. I still live in Detroit in a curious emotional way. And this is about Detroit. A Packard was a car manufactured in Detroit. I don't know when they started. I think they quit about 1953 or 4. They ruined it. I mean, it originally looked a lot like it was sort of an American version of a Rolls Royce. It was a very, except much more modest. And then after the war, when Cadillac started putting the tail fins and all that crap, they went for it. Then they died. But it was a going factory for a long time on the east side of Detroit. F. Scott Fitzgerald actually did work in advertising for a while, and the line that I quote by him, he actually did write. I don't think there's anything else you ought to know. There's a mention of my son escaping the American dream. My son came of age during the Vietnam War and went to Sweden. My oldest son. It's called The Two. When he gets off work at Packard, they meet outside a diner on Grand Boulevard. He's tired, a bit depressed, and smelling the exhaustion on his own breath, he kisses her carefully on her left cheek. Early April, and the weather has not decided if this is spring, winter, or what. The two gaze upward at the sky, which gives nothing away. The low clouds break here and there and let in tiny slices of a pure blue heaven. The day is like us, she thinks. It hasn't decided what to become. The traffic light at Linwood goes from red to green and the trucks start up so that when he says, "Would you like to eat?" she hears a jumble of words that means nothing, though spiced with things she cannot believe. Wooden Jew and lucky meat? He's been up late, she thinks. He's tired of the job, perhaps tired of their morning meetings. But then he bows from the waist and holds the door open for her to enter the diner, and the thick odor of bacon frying and new potatoes greets them both. And taking heart, she enters to peer through the thick cloud of tobacco smoke to see if their booth is available. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that there were no second acts in America. But he knew neither this man nor this woman, and no one else liked them, unless he stayed late at the office to test his famous one-liner, quote, "We keep you clean in Muscatine," on the woman emptying his wastebasket. Fitzgerald never wrote with someone present except for this woman in a gray uniform whose comings and goings went unnoticed. Even on those December evenings, she worked late, while the snow fell silently on the window sills and the new fluorescent lights blinked on and off. Get back to the two, you say. Not who ordered poached eggs, who ordered only toast and coffee, who shared the bacon with the other, but what became of the two when this poem ended? Whose arms held whom? Who first said, "I love you," and truly meant it? And who misunderstood the words, so longed for, and yet still so unexpected, and began suddenly to scream and curse until the waitress asked them both to leave? The Packard plant closed years before I left Detroit. The diner was burned to the ground in 67, 2 years before my oldest son fled to Sweden to escape the American dream. And the lovers, you ask? I wrote nothing about lovers. Take a look. Clouds, trucks, traffic lights, a diner, work, a wooden shoe, East Moline, poached eggs, the perfume of frying bacon, the chaos of language, the spices of spent breath after 8 hours of night work. Can you hear all I feared and never dared to write? Why the two are more real than either you or me? Why I never returned to keep them in my life? How little I now mean to myself or anyone else? What any of this could mean? Where you found the patience to endure these truths and confusions? Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture by award-winning poet Philip Levine. Levine has earned nearly every major prize available to an American poet and is the author of 16 books of poetry. We began with an introduction by the director of Boston University's Graduate Creative Writing Program, Leslie Epstein. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skogue with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.